member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Emmett!
I forgot about that part again. Jeez. I'm up here to introduce our AA speaker, whom I've seen around AA for a while. I'm a dual member, as you can guess. Heard him speak a few times and share parts of a story, but I've never heard the whole story. So I'm really looking forward to hearing Al's story. Al, you're up.
You're a short guy. You always spend a little bit of time adjusting the mic. Hi, everybody. My name's Al, and I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hi, Al!
I always like to say that for two reasons. One, in the foreword to the first edition of the big book, it says, we at Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show you other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. So I always say that because my sponsor used to say, this is a text. It's not a novel. Read it as a text and study it. The other reason I like to say I'm recovered, I guess there's two reasons. One, I'm a former trustee to the General Service Board in Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the service manual, we're defined as recovered because there's some kind of a law in the state of New York that says you can't have Alcoholics Anonymous serve on a non-profit corporation board. And the other reason I like to say I'm recovered is one of my mentors in the AA program, a fellow by the name of Mac from Winnipeg, Manitoba, who has long since passed away. And there's been a lot of talk of this being a spiritual program, and it is. Some of the best talks on AA spirituality that I have ever heard were given by Mac C. from Winnipeg, Manitoba. He's long since deceased, but his tapes are at the Gopher State Tape Library in Minnesota, and if you want some really good tapes on that, I would suggest that. But Mac used to say, my name is Mac, and I'm an alcoholic. And that means that I can no longer blame alcoholism for my irrational behavior. And neither can I. I want to tell you a story before I start about a drunk who went to the doctor. And he came home and he said to his wife, you look awful sad, you look depressed. And he said, there's a reason for that. The doctor told me that I have 24 hours or less to live. And she said, that's terrible. What would you like to do with your last 24 hours? And he said, well, I thought perhaps we could have a nice dinner. And then we could have a warm bath. And then we could go to bed and make love. And his long-suffering spouse says, that's easy for you to say. You don't have to get up tomorrow. Nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. I just like the story. You're an amazing group. I've been privileged over the years to give a few talks at roundups and conferences and things, and you are easily the most intense group of folks that I've ever seen. I feel like I'm back in university. I didn't take any notes there either, but all the rest of you guys are. You'll probably pass, and I'd flunk ACOA as well, I suppose, the story of my life. I want to tell you a little bit about what it was like with me and what happened and what it's like now. And as I do that, you'll come across a couple of heroes of mine. One's John Wayne, and the other's the Lone Ranger. And as I tell my story, you'll probably come to understand a little bit about these people. It's important that you know that I'm a five-time loser in Alcoholics Anonymous. I first went to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 19 years old and a student at the university here. I came here with high expectations. I had a high average in grade 12 from a boys' boarding school. I was class valedictorian, and I was literally voted the most likely to succeed. When I stood in front of that crowd of parents and teachers and kids to give the class valedictory that year, I want to assure you that I did not say that my name is Al, and that I'm about to graduate from this school. And in 12 months, I'm going to be arrested. I'm going to be in jail. and I'm going to be a raving drunk because I didn't know that. I don't come from a family of alcoholics. My mom and dad were not alcoholic. Yet of the 6 children in my family, 5 of them are members of AA. We're about exactly as far apart in sobriety as we are in age. When the sociologists discover us, there's going to be quite an experiment done, I'm sure. But like all families, we have our failure. He's my youngest brother. His name's Bob. Bob went to university and passed on his first try. Got a degree in engineering. Married. Has a nice young family. He's never been to jail. He's never been arrested. Never been on a fight on the street. Never thrown up on his pants. He's totally embarrassing. Shake any drunk or any tree in a social drinker will fall out. It's my brother. I want to read you something else from the big book. I'm not a big book Nazi, I want you to know, but this is the text that helped me to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. This is read at every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I think I've ever attended, with maybe the odd exception. And it's the so-called preamble, or how it works, in Chapter 5. At the end of that, after the steps are written, it says this: our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and that God could and would if he were sought. So my story is going to be about a search for God, of my understanding. And as a result of finding that God, I've been able to live sober, free of alcohol, since July 21st of 1971. I'm an active member of the New Freedom Group here in Saskatoon. We meet every Monday. For those of you who, at 8 o'clock, McClure United Church. For those of you who are looking for an open meeting, we have an open meeting the first Monday of each month where we have an Al-Anon and an AA speaker. I think we might be the only group in Saskatoon who does that on an ongoing basis. And you're welcome to attend. It's been growing quite quickly. Anyway, I'm a 5-time loser in Alcoholics Anonymous. And here I am at the university, expecting to be wildly successful. Always had been. I did a little drinking when I was in my home, but I was, I come from a small town, a prairie town, largely a farming community. And when young men of good family, and I'm not bragging or complaining, that's who I was, when we got wild in the summer when we were home from boarding school and got a little trouble from now and then and got in scraps and the police would arrest us from time to time, the old farmers and the business guys in that community would go, "He's just sowing his wild oats." Well, I was sowing mine more broadly and more deeply, perhaps, than most. And I was getting in a lot of trouble. But I didn't know I was in trouble. I also believed I was sowing my wild oats. Whatever that means. I mean, you talk about slogans. I mean, what is... what is that? It sounds in some ways vaguely pornographic. In other ways, it sounds vaguely agricultural. What the hell does that mean? I had no idea what. But I was so on to beat the blazes, I want you to know. So there I am, sowing away, and I get in, and I arrive in the city of Saskatoon at the age of 18 to attend university, and I'm expecting good things to continue to happen to me. And they didn't. I was free of all the controls of my family and of boarding school, and I got to drink in a bit. I always drank a bit, but I got to drink a real bit. And I went downhill very, very quickly. I did not have a gradual decline into hopeless and helpless drinking. I had a straight 90-degree drop into hopeless drinking. And my dad, who I loved more than life itself and who loved me, I was the apple of his eye, came into Saskatoon because he loved me and he knew I was flunking out of university, and he asked me, excuse me, what was wrong. And we were walking out of a restaurant standing on the corner of 2nd Avenue and 21st Street here in Saskatoon. And my dad, with tears in his eyes, asked me what's wrong. And in my anger and my frustration, I hit him. And I hit him again. And I walked away and I left him on the street, and I went home. That's where I had come so quickly, a matter of about 12 months. My dad, being the man that he was, knew something had to happen for me. And he had a best friend whose name was George. And I remember George as I was growing up. George used to come to our house, and him and my dad and my neighbor and a couple other guys played a game called Schmear. Now, if you're from, I see some heads nodding, you are some farm people here in the crowd. And they played Schmear, and they drank wine out of a gallon and plastic glasses. Didn't get drunk, they just had a good time, and they'd slam their hands on the table, and the wine glasses would jump up, and everybody would laugh, and it was a lot of fun. And George was always in the middle of it, charming, funny, great guy. But usually around 9, 10 o'clock, George turned from this nice guy into this jerk. And I never knew what was going on with George. And then some years passed, and George quit doing that. I didn't know he wasn't drinking. He just was the same funny guy, but he didn't turn into a jerk, and I didn't know why. George showed up at my doorstep when I was 19 years old and a student here and told me his name was George, and he was an alcoholic, and he had been sober since 1948. And he took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on top of Folks Finder Furs on the corner of 2nd Avenue and 20th Street here in Saskatoon. And I walked into that meeting, and there was a bunch of old guys, somewhat younger than I am right now, but they were sitting around a table, and the table had a light bulb hanging over the top, and there was a blanket on it, a big book, and a deck of cards, and they were playing cards. And the meeting started a bit later, and I had this wonderful meeting. They told these wonderful stories. In fact, they were so good, I had straight across the street to the Empire Hotel and told all my jock buddies in the bar what wonderful stories these guys in this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous told. And that was my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous. But it was a good exposure. I want you, if you hear very little from me today, there's a couple of things I want you to hear. This is one of them. I did not have any bad time at Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous did not fail me that day, nor did I fail Alcoholics Anonymous. I just wasn't full. One of my other buddies in AA says, you got to drink what you got to drink. If you're short an ounce, you got to drink the ounce. Maybe that's true of me. I don't know. In any event, I went back out drinking. My life got terrible. Met a girl on a blind date. Her name's Diane. First and only blind date I've ever been on. If you young single people here thinking of blind dates, don't do that. I'll be married to that blind date. If God willing, I don't die before November 16th of this year for 47 years. So be careful if you want to go. We have two children. We had a date. I got drunk. She got pregnant. We got married. That's kind of how it works. There's some slow counters out there. One, two, three. Yeah, there's... We told our eldest son the longest time that he was an early baby. Actually, he was a month late, but whatever. I was took back to Alcoholics Anonymous four more times. And I stand before you as an example of the progression of the disease of alcoholism. When I first went to that meeting when I was 19 years old, I was in trouble at school. A little bit of trouble with my dad. We got that fixed. Had my health, had my hair, had my own teeth when I went there. I've been sort of thrown in jail overnight sometimes for getting a little mouthy to RCMP members. But generally speaking, my life was not that bad. And I sat around, compared to what I was to become. And I sat around that table back when I was 19 years old, and I listened to these guys talk about going to jail, getting arrested, getting psych ward, blah, 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 suicide attempts, all these things. And I thought, wow, like if I ever get that bad, you'll find me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, 11 years later, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous on July 21st, 1971, in Yorkton, Saskatchewan, for what I hope is the last time. And I'm beginning to think this time it might last. I'm hopeful. Anyway, everything that those guys had talked about happened to them except for divorce and going to long terms in jail. The reason I did not get divorced had little to do with me. It had to do with my wife and the power of Al-Anon. Those of you in this room know how much I love Al-Anon. And one of the reasons I do is I believe that my wife, Diane, stayed with me because she got active in that program and allowed me a little bit of time to sort out my disease. I often wonder, were the shoe on the other foot, what would I have done? And I wonder if I would have been that patient. And I believe right now that had Diane left me, I don't know whether or not I would have made it. I know having her as part of my life was very important to me. And it was one of the motivating factors for my getting sober. It wasn't the motivating factor, but it was one of the motivating factors. But I must confess, she was getting a little narrow with me. But every couple of years, I would go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and her hopes would rise. And I would stay sober for a month, 3 months, one time 6 months, never did the steps, never got a sponsor, never got a home group. I always went back drinking. Well, I don't know about you guys, but she was a little narrow about things like that. And after I could continue to tell her I'm going to AA, the hope kind of went out of her eyes, and she kind of said, yeah, whatever, kind of thing, whatever the saying was back in those days. The day that I had my last drink, at least, again, I hope it's my last drink, I was in Yorkton, Saskatchewan. And to show you the depths to which I had fallen, or my disease had taken me, I had taken to hanging out with social drinkers. It can't get much worse than that for an alcoholic. Sort of in the hope that maybe I could learn to drink like them. I was never one, we were talking about this at lunch, I was never one who wanted to get drunk. I always wanted to get happy. I wanted to do a little dancing, do a little whatever. I went around with being happy. There was a lot of good stuff went around with just being happy. I could never quite get it. I had a friend who's also since passed away. As you get older, this happens all the time. And many of you have probably heard his tapes. His name was Tom B. from Winnipeg. And Tom used to say, I feel sorry for social drinkers. They don't know how alcohol actually feels. He said, when I take a drink, he said he puts it in his mouth. And he can feel the tingling in his lips. When I put it in my mouth, I also felt a little tingling right between my eyes, right about here. And it kind of tingled a little bit. And I'd swallow it. You could feel it kind of burning down. Oh, there's some drunks. I see the heads nodding. Kind of burning down. And it kind of hit your stomach. And it would gurgle around down there for a while, for a few seconds. And then, poof, as Tom used to say, it was like the sun coming up in the morning. And there was that instant sense of well-being. The world was good. This is how I want the world to be. And that's what I spent many years trying to capture. Never wanted to get drunk. Just wanted to watch the sun come up. That's all I ever really wanted. Never could do it. Lost the ability to control how much I drank. And I didn't always get drunk, but I usually did. And when I did, I ended up with some strange and wonderful people. A lot of fun, but we won't go there. That's just ugly. I want to tell you a story about that, though. When I was younger, I used to drive around Europe and Saskatchewan. I had a 47 Studebaker coupe. It was pink, and it had a three-in-a-tree transmission, and in the back seats, you could fold up the door handles. You could get 17 bottles of beer in every one of those little compartments. When I sold that car, in those days they had a little U-clamp held up the steering column. It wasn't enclosed like it is now, and under that clamp you could take a bottle of beer, and if you were really good at this, you could just hook it under that clamp, click it. See, you remember, don't you? You could just click it like that, and the bottle would come off. When I sold that car, that thing was just worn smooth. You couldn't do it in my car anymore. And I had this car, and I had those little dingle ball things around the windows, and I had some dice hanging from the mirror, and I had my girl Barb stuck up right up tight against me, so tight that I had to put in the clutch and she had to shift the gears, and I had my hair slicked back with Brill cream. I mean, I just glistened. One time I dived in the lake. I was teaching swimming at a lake outside of Humboldt. When I dived in, it was an oil slick, like a submarine had sunk or something. So I'm sitting there all slicked back, and I got my white T-shirt on, like James Dean, and I got my shirt rolled up. I got a pack of Buckingham cigarettes stuck under there, and I'm leaning against the door, and I'm putting in the clutch, and Barb is shifting, and we're drinking beer, and I mean, life is as good as it can possibly get. Talk about a search for serenity, that's it. Pink 47, Studebaker girlfriend, Bill Cremens, and beer. That's it. That's as good as it can possibly get. We're driving along, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police pulled up. Now, I was well known in that town, mainly because I got arrested a lot. And what happened in Humboldt in those days was you got arrested on the weekend, and court was on Tuesday. Remember? Tuesday. And so nobody put you in jail yet in those days. They gave you a ticket, and you were supposed to show up in court on Tuesday. And this is how the deal went. You pulled over, and they only had a little mirror up by the side of our window, and you'd look up in the mirror, and you'd see these shiny brown boots with purple, with navy pants and yellow stripes on them, walking to the car. And the Mounties, God love them, at least in those days, were always very polite people. And they'd knock on the window. And I'd roll down the window. And they'd say, "Good evening, sir." I love being called sir. They'd say, "Good evening, sir. Can I see some identification, please?" Well, for goodness sakes, they arrested me every other weekend for crying out loud. I mean, they knew perfectly well who I was. So, you talk about think, think, think. This is a slogan that should be taken out of every 12-step program in the world. I got to thinking. And this is what I thought. I pulled out my pack of Buckingham cigarettes, took off the silver tinfoil paper that's on them, rolled it up in the shape of a bullet, and I said, "This silver bullet will tell you who I am." That's what the Lone Ranger used to say when the cops arrested him. I found out there's more than one way to exit the door of a 47 Studebaker. That night I ended up in jail. We got to singing down there, and this cop was so goofy, he said, "If you guys don't shut up, I'm going to kick you out." Anyway, so my life had become totally unmanageable. That night that I decided to hang out with some social drinkers, I went to a sportsman's dinner in Yorkton, Saskatchewan, to watch the replay of the U.S. Open. I'm an addicted golfer. And I bought some tickets, we had some beer, and we watched the replay, and about 10 o'clock, my social drinking friend went home. Well, I've had 6 beer. The sun's only come up twice yet, and I need to see some more sunrises. In those days, we had archaic liquor laws in this province, and you got a permit for these kind of events, and at 12 o'clock, the permit ran out, and the booze had to be gone. So what they did, about 11:30, they auctioned off the booze. I bought a bottle of Lemon Heart rum. Now, I'm dressed up. I was the branch manager of a mortgage company in those days. Had a good job, company car, all of this stuff. And I got a nice suit on, and I got a tie. I always had this image that if you look good, nobody would ever know. My wife and I spent hours pretending nobody in our nice neighborhood of Yorkton knew that the man of the house was a raving alcoholic. So I got this nice suit on, silk tie, and I'm looking good. At least I think I am. And one of the big issues with me was nobody knows that I'm an alcoholic. I had 2 big issues around my alcoholism. One was nobody knows that I'm an alcoholic, and 2, I'm a smart guy. I can figure this out. I'll get this. It just take me a matter of doing some reading, some research, and I'll get this. I don't need these steps and these meetings and all this stuff. How hard can it be? I'll get it. In any event, the progression had continued. I'm in a lot of trouble. I'm at this sportsman's dinner. I got my bottle of Lemon Heart rum. I'm playing dice. I'm winning. I got money in every pocket. I'm drinking the rum. I'm walking home. The sun's coming up. A beautiful morning in July in Yorkton, Saskatchewan. Those of you who aren't from here will not know how absolutely beautiful our mornings can be here sometimes. And it was just one of those spectacular prairie mornings that we have. And I'm stumbling down the road. And to say that I'm drunk is an understatement. I'm capital D-R-U-N-K, drunk. I am ripped. I'm staggering and I'm stumbling. I'm not driving, mainly because I lost my car again. I always lost my car. I got drunk and my little car disappeared. It was the most amazing thing. And I could tell you stories about me and cars that are hair-raising, if I had any hair to raise. So I'm walking home, and I'm drunk. After I got home, I discovered I had thrown up on this fancy silk tie. and this fancy navy suit and this fancy white shirt, probably on my fancy pants and my fancy shoes as well. I look really great. And I'm walking down the street of this nice neighborhood, and there's two little girls playing in a sandbox, the kind they make out of a big tractor tire, in the front yard of this nice home in Yorkton, Saskatchewan. And I love little kids. And I walked by, so I noticed them. And one of them said to her little buddy, "Look at the drunk." Oh, I stopped and looked. What would a drunk be doing in this neighborhood? And for some reason, I'd been told I was an alcoholic by myself, by my spouse, by my parents, by assorted doctors, psychiatrists, counselors, priests, cops, all kinds of people told me I was an alcoholic. Yeah, whatever. Never heard it. This one I heard. And this big book talks about each of us has a moment of clarity where we can clearly see where we have been and clearly see where we're going. That was my moment of clarity. I knew and I accepted that I was an alcoholic, that my life was totally unmanageable, and I am drunk. So I staggered home. It's early in the morning. Diane's sitting around the table with our boys. They're very small. And they're having breakfast. And I walked in my magnificent splendor. And I said to her, "Diane, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous." You can imagine how impressed she was. I said, "Could you phone them for me, please?" She said, "No." She'd been going to Al-Anon. I used to flop in my favorite chair, and I'd hear crinkling under my butt, and I'd pull it out and be a pamphlet that says, "Do you think you're an alcoholic?" Really subtle. So I tried to call Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't imagine anybody had ever thought about how phones work. I never had until that moment. If you want to get somebody who you want to talk to, you got to get those seven numbers in the right order. Who knew? When you're as drunk as I am, and they had those old rotary phones back in those days for you younger folks, there was no push button. You had a little hole. You had to put your finger in it, and one ringy-dingy, two ringy-dingy kind of thing. And I got some strange people out of bed that said some really unkind things about my mother. But I finally got a hold of the guy that I was trying to get a hold of. His name was Cal, my first sponsor. I say my first because he's passed away too. But Cal came over. Now, this is the second thing I want you to hear from me. For those of you who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous, or those of you who know and care about members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for those of you who know people who take 12-step calls, as I do, there's a rumor sometimes around AA that you don't go do a 12-step call with somebody who's drunk. Because this demonstrates, I'm not sure what it demonstrates. To me, it demonstrates he's probably an alcoholic, but anyway, you don't do those things. Well, I'm really glad that Cal P. did not subscribe to that. Because I don't know how long my moment of clarity would have lasted. Cal came over, said some real spiritual things that I can't repeat to you, because he was still alive when I began speaking, and he said, "If you ever swear at a microphone, I'll kill you," so I can't tell you what he said to me. But he said some things that were not very nice and ended up, "Put the little blankety-blank to bed and call me when he wakes up." And they did. Diane and Cal put me to bed. And I slept that sleep that many alcoholics know about. You wake up, you have horrible nightmares. There was no detox around that area in those days, so I guess I was detoxing. And there was fluids of variety of types, I suppose, coming out of my body. And I'd get up from time to time, and there'd be another guy sitting beside the bed. And I'd go off to the bathroom, and I'd throw up. And these guys would hold my head and wipe my face with a cold towel and put me back to bed. I came to understand later that they were the seven members of the Dunlop Group in Yorkton, Saskatchewan. That's all there was. Next day, they took me to a meeting, what I now recall as my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, July 21st, 1971. And I sat in that meeting, and they had coffee in glass cups, incidentally. This is one of my pet peeves. It was one thing that's going to destroy Alcoholics Anonymous, it's styrofoam cups. I learned more about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous washing cups after the meetings than I've ever learned anyplace else. So if you have in my group, even though I'm supposed to be a member of some, seniority, seemed I only get one vote, and we've gone to styrofoam cups, and I am not pleased. I'm not yet resentful, but I'm working on it. In any event, all the guys were pouring coffee. I went to get one. They wouldn't let me have one. They gave me a Coke. Also came in a glass bottle in those days with a small neck. Because they said if I took a coffee of the shape that I was in, I might spill that hot liquid on a part of my body I may once again find useful. And I'm pleased to report that also turned out to be true, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat in that meeting, and I don't remember anything. I was sick. I remember nothing. Except I sat on one of those tacky, plum-colored, velour sort of Chesterfields that was all worn and everything. And that's all I remember. But I remember standing up to say the Lord's Prayer, and I was embarrassed. At that time, I was a lapsed Catholic. I wanted nothing to do with churches, nothing to do with God, nothing to do with religion. Thank you very much. But they stood up, and they were going to say the Lord's Prayer. And I wanted to stay there, because I was tired. I went to that meeting not with much hope of recovery. I had a track record that would suggest recovery was not likely for me. And I believed that I was one of those who was constitutionally incapable of being honest with himself, that I would die drunk. My only hope was that I would die quickly. What I saw my future as being, and I didn't want this to be, that I would eventually get fired. That was in trouble. Diane would leave me. That would happen. I'd get worse and worse jobs. I'd end up somewhere on Skid Row. With an old raincoat, socks on, no shoes, three-day growth of beard, some puke down the front of my shirt, and begging for quarters to buy a bottle of Muscatel. That's what I saw as my future, and I did not want that to happen. I had no hope for recovery. My life had become kind of a long gray tunnel. I just stumbled through it. There was no joy. There was no happiness. There was no sleep. There was no fun. It was just sad, and it was dreary. It wasn't exciting. I had tried to commit suicide some years before, was unsuccessful. That only taught me that God didn't care. He wouldn't even let me kill myself. So that's where I was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Then they had the nerve to ask me to stand up, join hands, say the Lord's Prayer, and stand in a circle like of a cult or some bloody thing. But I wanted to stay. So I did. I don't remember the Lord's Prayer, but I remember a guy on my left. His name was Orville. Big guy, hard hands, calloused. They were black. He was a welder. Dirt was ingrained in his skin. Tough guy. Looked tough anyway. Wasn't, but he looked tough. Scary. He said the Lord's Prayer. He held my hand. Damn near broke it. Held my hand, and I felt those calluses and that stuff. And Orville, after the Lord's Prayer was over, hugged me and said, "You come back." That I remember. Don't remember anything else, but I remember Orville saying, "You come back." And he didn't strike me as the kind of guy that was really into giving hugs a whole hell of a lot, but he did. And I came back. Well, I didn't really want to come back that bad, and my sponsor's really a big guy. He was really big. And he got me. I mean, in those days, they got you. I mean, I don't remember ever asking Cal to be my sponsor. He says I did. And it's possible in my stupefied state that I did. I suspect I was kidnapped, is what I believe. And I was held for ransom. I asked Cal one time, I said, "You got a grade 4 education. You pump gas at a gas station you don't even own. You're a gas pump jockey. What could you possibly teach a guy like me?" He said, "How to not drink." I said, "That would be helpful." He said, "I thought it might." We began to trudge the road of happy destiny. Cal had a 47 Chrysler limo that he'd restored. And all seven of us, now eight, would pile into the Chrysler and off we go to meetings. There was only one meeting in Yorkton in those days. And we sat in the back of that old Chrysler smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee out of paper cups. And I'm a pretty cocky guy, but I was terrified back there. But I listened to those guys, and that's where I learned what I belong to. And something else I'd like to say to you, if you're, whatever program you're in, find out what you belong to. I challenge anybody. I'm a student of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. I challenge anybody to study those history, the history of any program, and come to the conclusion, any other conclusion, than God must have invented this thing. The way I figure it happened is this. God was, wherever God is, looking down on us, or up at us, wherever he is, watching us dying in our own puke, by our own hands, by violence, whatever the case may be, watching the damage and the wreckage that we cause in our lives and the lives of whom we love. And he said to himself, I got to do something for these people. But they're alcoholics, and they have this huge ego problem. If they think that I invented it, they won't do anything. So let them think they invented it. And he got a hold of a guy named Bill Wilson who was laying in a hospital bed. And Bill talks about it in the book. It was as if a cold wind blew down from the mountain. Only alcoholic I've ever heard of who had a cold wind blowing over him. I know I sure didn't. And Bill sat down and wrote the 12 steps. I've been privileged to be in his home, where he wrote the steps. I've been privileged to sit with his late wife, Lois. She tells me he wrote those things in a matter of hours. Like it just flowed out of him. Come on. I mean, Bill was a smart guy, but come on. I mean, it had to be something greater than Bill, and Bill in his writings would suggest that it was. So God invented Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what would have happened to me if God hadn't invented Alcoholics Anonymous and if my sponsor, Cal, hadn't been the kind of guy that didn't mind making 12-step calls to stinky drunk alcoholics? I'll tell you what would have happened to me. It happened to me all the time. I'd wake up in the morning, and I'd have been really sick because I drank a real lot of booze that night. And I'd have been shaking, and I'd have been throwing up. But I'm not stupid. I learned a long time ago that when you feel that bad, all you need to do is find a little whiskey. Doesn't even take all that much, just a little bit. I had a friend who bought cheap Ryan Good Rye. One he said was throwing up whiskey and one was getting well whiskey. I wasn't that smart. Have a little whiskey and pretty soon it'll go away. And the way my mind works, pretty soon I'll get to thinking. Bad news, never get to thinking, but I get to thinking. And I think, well, it was her fault. If she would have been nicer to me, I wouldn't have drank that 26 of rum on top of those 20 beer. It's her fault. It's the cop's fault. It's my boss's fault. And pretty soon I'd be back doing exactly what I was doing, trying to control my drinking, waiting for the sun to come up, getting drunk and getting in trouble if Cal hadn't come. How did Cal get there? You ever thought about how these things happened? Dr. Bill Wilson's in Akron, Ohio. He's sober a very brief period of time. Think about this. There's no AA. There's no central office. There's no big book. There's no answering service. It's just Bill. And his conviction that if he works with the other alcoholics, he might not have to drink again. And he's in the bar of the Mayflower Hotel in Akron, Ohio. And if you're an alcoholic, you know what this is like. He's lonesome, he's restless, he's irritable, he's discontented. And he knows that if he doesn't do something about that, he's going to drink again. He goes to a directory of churches in a phone booth in that hotel. And they put him in touch with Dr. Bob. The way I understand it, Dr. Bob's half-bagged. Bill actually talked to his wife, Ann. Bob, because I'm told he was a nice guy, not like most alcoholics, decided he didn't want to have a battle with Ann, so he agreed to talk to Bill for a while. Probably to get Ann off his back is how I figured. That's what I would have done. I just said, write to Ann, I'll talk to this guy, whatever. And then as soon as he goes, we'll do whatever. Bill came and talked to Bob. Now, Bob, being a physician, had all kinds of help for his drinking. Nothing had worked. Bill came, and they sat face to face, eyeball to eyeball. And Bill did not lecture Bob. Bill shared with Bob his experience, strength, and hope. He told how he was powerless over alcohol, how his life was totally unmanageable, how he had this dream, this spiritual inspiration, that if he worked with other alcoholics, he might not have to drink again. And Bob got sober. He was to drink one more time when he went away to a convention, but he got sober and died sober. That was the first 12-step call. Now, I thought about how that must have been. So those two guys had this 12-step call, And then they made some more 12-step calls and some more 12-step calls. And AA crossed from the U.S. into Canada, into Toronto, and somehow ended up in Yorkton, Saskatchewan. So that my sponsor, Cal P., got sober. So when Al H. picked up the phone on July the 20th, 1971, there was somebody there to answer the phone and to carry to me the same message of recovery that Bill carried to Bob, the basic service of Alcoholics Anonymous. And why I am so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous, why I spent most of my sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, very involved in general service, is a small attempt to try to give a little bit back for what was so freely given to me. I stand here as the recipient of a gift of sobriety that was given to those who went before me. I stand here only because there was men and women around me and in this province and in North America and other places who cared enough about the still suffering alcoholic to keep AA alive so when this drunk needed it. And I would suggest that's true of Al-Anon as well. And it's our responsibility. Another thing I'd like you to think about. It's our responsibility to keep these programs alive for the people who come after us. I have two sons. Neither of them appears so far to have a problem with alcohol. Knock on wood. However, as the children of an alcoholic, they're 50% more likely than the average population to have an alcohol problem. If either of my boys ever have the need to call AA, I want somebody to be at the end of that phone for them. And there's only one person who can do that, and that's me. I have to do my bit. If I'd have gone to the Dunlop Block in Yorkton, Saskatchewan, and the door was closed, I'd have walked back up the steps from that ugly old basement club room and stood on the street, and I would have been sad. And I would have looked across the street, and there's the Yorkton Hotel, with the little arrow saying bar. And I would have gone to the place I know where I can get comfort. Alcohol, for those of you who aren't alcoholic, I want to assure you, is an absolutely consistent producer. It will always do exactly what it's intended to do. The big book says we drink because we like the effect produced by alcohol, and that's why I drank. No other reason. I would have been sad. I would have wanted to get the effect. So I have a responsibility, and I believe you do. That's the end of the homily. I'll now continue with my story. So I came back to AA. Dunlop Group was real good for me. They were not the most, not being negative, they were not the most actively involved in steps in the big book. They tended to use a little black book from Hazelden that had the thought for the day or something, and they dissected it to death. But it was enough for me. And what that says to me, it reinforces AA's so-called definition, that we're a fellowship of men and women. We share our blah, blah, blah. It was the fellowship that kept me sober. I was always with those guys. Always. Number 8 came along. His name was also Al. My sponsor, Cal, I don't know why he did this to me. No, what a kind, humble sort of man that I am. In any event, Cal had fingers the size of German sausages. And he, big guy, and he'd pound me on my chest. It sounded like a drum going off. And he'd call me Wheel. I have no idea why you call a nice guy like me Wheel. He called me Wheel, and he abused me. My wife used to say, if anybody ever talked to him like that, there'd be a fight in the street. He said, why aren't you hitting him? I said, well, he's 6'2", 240, for God's sakes. I mean, I might be an alcoholic. I'm not stupid. And he'd pound me, and he'd pound me. And he was a big book Nazi, but he would never, ever hurt me. Along comes the other Al. Now, the other Al was beaten. I was beaten, but I hadn't quite given up. The other Al was beaten, and Cal treated him, my God, like he blew fairy dust all over this guy. You know, one hand he'd be smacking me around, on the other hand he'd be begging this guy to come to AA. Me, he literally grabbed by the ear and dragged me to AA. In any event, it worked for either of us. I got to Winnipeg, I was transferred. Amazing thing happened after I got sober. I got a huge promotion. I don't know whether those two events are connected. It's likely that they possibly are. And I got to Winnipeg, my sponsor. Do you know this happens in AA? It's like football. I was traded to Winnipeg. And I got to Winnipeg, and there's a phone message waiting at this one place, and his name said he was Al as well. There's a lot of Al's in my life. He said, I'm your sponsor. I said, I don't even know who you are. He said, no, you said it's not important. He said, I have a service station down here. You will come down here and you will visit a coffee. Nice guy. He was a heck of a guy. We're still very good friends, and I'm pleased to report he's still alive. But I got involved in something called a big book study in Winnipeg. 13 of us. And a lawyer named Tom was the chair of this thing. He made us sign a contract that we would complete 14 weeks and we would about whatever it was. But we did. And I did the 12 steps out of the big book with my sponsor and with Tom and with those 13 guys as a group. It was probably the most significant experience in my life. We sat there for a long time, every Wednesday night, read out of the big book, did a step. One of the most powerful things that ever happened to me there was kneeling in a circle with those men and saying the prayer together out of the big book, the step three prayer. Because I came there fighting step two. I come to accept step one, I came there fighting step two. I had no doubt that I was insane, but a power greater than myself, I could live with that. But again, I'm not stupid. I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer. And you can call it power greater than yourself, whatever you want. I mean, let's face it. The next step says God. I mean, I knew where they were leading me. I mean, come on. Treat me like I'm an adult, they used to say. Anyway, we got into this, and I knelt down and held hands with those guys, something I thought I would never do. And I made a decision in front of them. It's important that you do step three if you can with another human being. Our big book at least talks about that. And I was privileged to do that with a group of human beings. And I offered my life to God as I understood him. I'm not going to bore you with all of my hang-ups about how I understood him. Looking back on it, it was odd. But in any event, I did. And I will tell you this, that irrespective of my odd perception of what that was, something happened to me that night. I had no doubt that I had turned my will over my life over to God as I understood him. How I understood him, that's another whole question. And I would say this about that, that over the years, and as the result of doing these steps, I don't think, for me at least, there was any understanding. The understanding of God that I had then and the understanding of God that I have now are so significantly different that there's actually no comparison. It's silly even to call them both God as I understand them. There is no relationship between those two. What's important is that it was enough for me to continue. And it was important that I continue, and I did. I did step four. Difficult steps for me were step six and seven. If you remember what I said earlier, I did and still do put a very high priority on independence. I put a high priority on the ability to resolve issues as they come up. I believe people do have that ability, providing that they're reasonably well. For me, I had to know where to draw the line. There's issues that I can resolve for myself, and there's issues that I can't. One of the things I needed to come to understand, and I had proved in my own life with my five trips in and out of AA, that I could not deal with these defects of character. I had to accept that I was powerless over them. I had to accept in humility. I had to find somebody who could. And I take you back to the ABCs that were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. That no human power could have relieved my alcoholism. B, my alcoholism is easily defined as all of, along with my physical manifestations, is my ability to control my emotions, my so-called defects of character. So I asked God, as humbly as I could, I can't do this anymore. I can't fix these things. And that was very difficult for me. You can. Please do. And to a large degree, he has. You've heard it said you can take them back. I'm not a perfect person. But what the 12 step has done for me, or the 12 steps have done for me, it's allowed me to live my life like any other person. I don't walk around as if I'm healed and I'm perfectly well. But I'm no sicker most days than most everybody else. I can live my life comfortably. I can participate in society. I can be a husband. I can be a father. I can be a brother. I can be a friend. I can be a sponsor. Those are things that normal people take for granted. I never could. I want to say this about step nine. I almost forgot. Three Mondays ago, at my group, somebody said something that I hear an awful lot. My wife knows that I'm trying to get sober. She knows I'm trying to be a better person, and that's my amend to her. Well, okay, fair enough. My book, published 1939, I assume the same as his, has the word direct in it. Now, as I understand amends, and this is my understanding, this is Cal and Al and Stan and a few other people that have been part of my life in the sponsorship role, old George, that I have to accept responsibility for what I have done. And I need to make direct amends to people whom I've harmed, and I've done that. I sat with my wife, I sat with my children, I sat with my mother, I sat with my father, and made direct amends. My mother, God love her, little Irish girl that she was, never accepted that. She accepted that I was sorry, but she really believes that it was her fault, that all of her children were alcoholics, and all but one, the failure. And she went to her grave that way. But I want to tell you, again, a little bit about some of the rewards of being sober. When my dad died, I was the only sober one in our family. My brother was just coming around. And Dad was laying in the hospital, and they called the family together. Now, because most of my brothers and sisters are alcoholics, most of them were drunk. That's what you do in times of stress. Not a good place to be drunk. Not in a hospital where someone's dying. And we're all standing around Dad's bed. And the reason I raise this isn't as a pity party. This is where my concept of God began to change. Really change. My dad was a diehard cradle Catholic all his life. Contributed to the church, was active in the church, loved the church, saw its imperfections, still loved it for what it was. He was a really good man. Loved God and believed in God. And he's dying. There is no doubt that he's dying, and there's no doubt that it's close. And any of you who've ever watched, been with somebody when they died, you know when it's time. And it was his time. And he grabs my hand, I'm holding his hand, and he says, and I just got the sign, I got to speed it up, and he says, I'm scared. And I remember thinking to myself, this is wrong. It's wrong that a man who has the belief system that he has would be scared. So I think I said the first selfless prayer I've ever said in my life, and I said words something like this, please God, take this fear from my dad. It's not right. And as I stand before you, he squeezed my hand, he was almost out of it, said thank you, relaxed, smiled, and died. So, with my keen alcoholic mind, I'm thinking, there's got to be a God. G-O-D, never mind higher power, never mind whatever, there's got to be a God. And that God intervened, in my mind, directly in my dad's life, and therefore in mine. And I've told you before how much I love my dad. And what this meant to me was this. Even in his dying, he gave me one of the greatest gifts I've ever had. And that's returning me to a life of faith, where I could once again embrace a faith that I was raised in and become active in. So, what began as a hopeless and a helplessness, wanting only to rest, has become 39 years of continued sobriety. I'm able to live my life as a contributing member of society. That's important to me. I'm a giver now, not a taker. And as a husband, yada yada. I want to just close by reading this because I always do. Page 164 of our big book, from the chapter, A Vision for You, the last words in our book. This book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him each morning in your meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come. if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past and give freely of what you find and join us. We will be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us if you trudge the road to happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you very much.